You know, if Jim hadn't been here, I could have given part of that speech on behalf of Young Americans Foundation because of my admiration for the work they've done. Could I ask Ron Robertson, who's the president of the foundation, in the back room to please stand so we can all see? And a number of the vital young staff that animate that program are with us here tonight. Thomas Jefferson is with us and will be speaking in some few moments. He has had many titles in his life. He prefers to be known as Mr. Jefferson, a man of the people. But that is a judgment that you will have to make after his presentation. He's going to speak to us and also take our questions, and the bus will be held until that such time as we are through. Let me begin by saying that Stan kindly asked me to talk a little bit about ISI, given the heavy predominance of our young people here and on the program. And I'm going to talk about it, but in an indirect way. I'm going to talk about the importance of the mission to those folks rather than our specific programs. We have the luxury that all of you all know about ISI. The Philadelphia Society grew from ISI, and we have a sort of a heavy program which has a lot of moving parts that I'm not going to tell you about things you already know. Alexander Solzhenitsyn once remarked that a people which no longer remembers has lost its history and its soul. That profound insight underscores the centrality of our deliberations this weekend. It's especially haunting when applied to the theme of tonight's session, which is the founders and the rising generation. It's appropriate that we gather this weekend in Williamsburg, where the myths of history surround us, to discuss ways in which to recover our historical consciousness. The alarming rate at which historical ignorance and, more than that, apathy are both advancing in the ranks of our fellow citizens puts the future of the nation as conceived by our founders at risk. Indeed, you probably have seen the same symposium that I saw in a distinguished journal this fall, where impeccable conservatives are even raising the question whether they can retain allegiance to a system of government that they view is, quote, subject to a long train of abuses and usurpations, echoing the language of the Declaration, usurpations of peremptory courts and big government out of control. The very fact that conservatives, who almost by definition support the order of our country, raise this revolutionary question is an indication how serious the situation has become. Now, how have we come to this pass? Certainly one of the principal reasons is the widening gap between the founding generation and the rising generation. This chasm is a generation gap of a different kind than is commonly referred to by the political posters. I mean here something different than the chronological division or separation between the generations, but rather a separation more in consciousness than in time. Today's high school and college youth exist in a historical sense a mere 220 years from the signing of the Declaration. That's not very long as history goes, but it may well as be 2,020 years. Survey after survey confirms what we know from our own interaction, that the rising generation is learning next to nothing about American history. What is at stake here is more than a lost acquaintance with names, dates, events, figures, as important as that acquaintance is. More importantly, the rising generation increasingly is being denied the acquisition of an historical consciousness and the cultivation of the discipline of historical memory. The fact that most citizens today complacently adopt the abrogation of power by governments and courts to described in the symposium I referred to, at the expense of their own sovereignty, is not surprising if they don't know about that sovereignty in the first place. What is the significance of historical consciousness and its connection to our present discontents? Wilfred McClay, a historian of distinction who was with us this weekend, put the connection this way in a recent and poetic address, I thought, to the Heritage Foundation. Historical consciousness, McClay writes, is to civilized society what memory is to the individual identity. One cannot say who or what one is. One can't say one is anything without some selective retention of experience and source of continuity. One cannot learn, use language, pass on knowledge, raise offspring, or even dwell in society without the aid of memory. And I skip a few passages here to come to his conclusion. A culture, says McClay, without memory will necessarily be barbarous, no matter how technologically advanced and sophisticated, because the daily drumbeat of artificial sensations and amplified events will drown out all other sounds, including the strains of an older music. Now, what is it about the American founding generation that makes them worthy of memory in the rising generation? We heard much about that this weekend by implication. I'll add a couple of things. For some, the extraordinary extent to which large numbers of our forebearers were prepared to sacrifice their fortunes and their very lives to preserve liberty, for not just for themselves and not primarily for themselves, but for their posterity, as they said, is enough to merit distinction. For others, it's the extraordinary fact that the founding era produced a talent amazing to us and unexpected at the time. Cyrus Dean was a member of the Continental Congress, and he wrote in Home in 1775, and I'm quoting here, "Times like these call up genius, which slept before, and stimulate it in action to a degree that eclipses what might have been fixed as a standard." And in 1789, David Ramsey, a historian of my own South Carolina, noted that the heroic events of the war and the succeeding years of constitutional deliberation had not only required but created talents. Many said, and I'm quoting, spoke, wrote, and acted with an energy far surpassing all expectations, which could be reasonably founded on their previous achievements. And in our own day, the historian Edmund S. Morgan has expressed a similar sentiment when he observed that if one were to make a list of the great men of American history, by whatever standard one chooses to measure greatness, an astonishingly large proportion would be found in those whose careers began or culminated in the Revolution. It would be hard to find in all the rest of American history more than two or three to rank with Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, Hamilton, John Adams, or Madison One. little interpolation. Well, I think it is almost a matter of common sense that when a society wishes to encourage right conduct in its own citizens, the ability of history, and especially the history of that very society, to throw forward exemplars of right conduct is not to be underestimated. I remember once on Washington's birthday, by coincidence, I was walking in Georgetown with a young German who had been sent to me by mutual friends to entertain in America. And he noticed in the storefronts pictures of Washington and various figures with wigs and that sort of thing. You know what he said? He said, "You know, you don't know how lucky you are that you can look up to the founders of your own country. We cannot do that in modern Germany." It was a statement that gave me pause. Well, the principal reasons and the substantive reasons that the new generation should look to the founders were laid out in our earlier deliberations, and I won't belabor them. I might give you an example, though, of something from my own experience. And that is, take, for example, an ignorance of the fact that our liberties are really protected by the structural safeguards of the Constitution rather than the mere recitation of rights. It is the great vertical separation between the powers of the three branches and the division of the enumerated powers versus the reserved powers. And it's the great horizontal separation between the federal government and that reserved to the states. Those are the structures which divide power against itself in a way that protect our liberties, and that is what the founders placed their faith in, not the recitation of rights, cheap and easy and available in the Soviet Constitution. Now, if you don't know this, you might fall into the trap of the civil libertarians, who say they're for civil liberties. They are, after all, civil libertarians. But in their rush to protect the latest right or to advance the latest cause, sweep aside the constitutional structures as irrelevant of federalism, of separation of powers, of enumerated powers. And in their rush to judgment, who are the principal enemies? Who are the most destructive agents of our civil liberties? Civil libertarians. History matters. The stakes are high. The stakes are very high. But when we attempt to unveil these and other ways in which the founders are worthy of a central place in the individual and collective memory, we are stopped in our tracks by important prevailing powers. One is the reigning utilitarian approach to history, which is surely one overwhelming reason why such a large historical generation gap, a gap in consciousness, not in time, currently exists. A utilitarian historical theory is not a new problem. It existed in the early part of our century. Those on our side have waged a pretty good guerrilla war against John Dewey and his allies. But it shouldn't surprise us that transmitting the legacy of the founding fathers will never be a central concern of historians who are chiefly occupied with constructing a program directly relevant to their students' interests and in concert with their students' personal or professional goals. Now, the extreme of this view was best expressed 30 years ago by the radical educator Edgar Wesley in an infamous essay called Let's Abolish History. In it, Wesley argued that students need a history they can, quote, appreciate. And I'm quoting here, no teacher at any grade level, he asserted, should teach a course in history as content. To do so is confusing, unnecessary, frustrating, futile, pointless, and as illogical as teaching a course in the World Almanac, the dictionary, or the encyclopedia. No, he says, history should be utilized and exploited, not studied, learned, or memorized. Well, needless to say, such an ardent utilitarianism and even mild expressions of the same view that we hear in our daily discourse on these matters have proved disastrous for the study of history generally and the cultivation of an historical appreciation of our American forebears in particular. Now, a corollary to the utilitarian approach to history is the scourge of moral relativism, also in the modern academy, also not new. That's why ISI was founded back in 1953, if you want to get to the bottom of it, but in new garb. And one of the catchphrases of the new garb is multiculturalism. Now, relativism has stalked the academy for many years, and the two that are most dangerous and detrimental and are newly virulent in our academy are the relativism asserted as among cultures and also the relativism asserted as among standards. After all, the transmission of culture depends on the assumption that there is in the body of Western thought truths that are worth preserving through the ages, truths that justify the immense effort and expense of the academic establishment traditionally entrusted with that transmission. But what if there is no truth? Or more specifically, what if the traditions and institutions of the West and the moral order that they imply are neither more or less valuable than those of other cultures? Well, then, concern for transmitting an inherited body of learning doesn't matter, because the culture of the West itself does not signify. So once the leveling scythe of relativism has cut through the higher achievements of civilization, we are exempted from thinking through such fundamental questions as what is justice, what should be loved, what deserves to be defended, what is courage, what is noble, what is base, why do civilizations flourish, and why do they decline? For relativism also attacks any notion of standards that proceed from a moral order than that form the basis of right conduct. Forrest MacDonald, who's with us this weekend but not tonight, has observed that the framers themselves were not strangers to the notion of moral relativism. He notes that the founders put it to their own use with the understanding that a regime must be suited to the manners and morals of a people if it is to endure. They would, he continues, have been appalled to argue further that the modern idea that Western civilization is no better than other civilizations, that the heritage of the West is not superior to, as well as different from, that of the East, that the Judeo-Christian tradition is not morally superior to, as well as different from, that of Islam or paganism or tribalism, that one so-called lifestyle is as good as another. Such thinking, if it can be so described, says MacDonald, is a rationalization for being unable to measure up to the duty of living in accordance with and transmitting the higher values. Political correctness, identity politics, the practical manifestations of this relativistic approach, the new manifestations of an old problem. There are, of course, other trends besides utilitarianism and moral relativism, which make it difficult to advance the founders as a group worthy of study, of appreciation. But I want to turn finally to something different, to a consideration of some hopeful developments in recent years that can perhaps serve to embolden us in our efforts to close the widening consciousness gap between the rising generation and the founding generation. I guess the first cause for tempered hope is the proliferation of the idea-mediating institutions on our side dedicated to addressing the woeful neglect of our founding principles among the rising generation. You heard about one of them from Jim Taylor. Frank Chodorov, who founded ISI back in 1952, said, and I'm quoting here, "What was done can be undone if there is a will for it." Well, there's been some progress, I think, in institutionalizing that will, in part, through the mediating institutions of Young America's Foundation. ISI is one of those, the Federalist Society of Gene Meyer, Ed Forner's Heritage Foundation, Larry Arn and Charles Kessler's Claremont Institute, Father Sirica's Acton Institute, many others, some of which are in this room. I won't go through the whole list. They tend to make a difference in my observation over many years. And what they tend to do is provide a framework and a support for individuals who are disposed to make a difference but who do not otherwise have the resources to do so. I must say that in the 25 years or so since I've watched these things, there's been amazing proliferation of scholars, of think tanks, of libraries of books, not just books, but libraries of books, of profound and important public policy studies. So much that the real problem is not the source of that material, but its application. The real challenge is to take all of that richness and fecundity and to translate it into making a difference. So the will that animates institutions like the ones I mentioned and the others that I didn't, that will doesn't come just from anywhere. It comes from a source. And for most of us, the direct source has been the intellectual legacy of a broad-ranging group of conservative intellectuals who, at a critical moment in history, came forward and gave their all to support the faltering institutions of the West. I'm a little overcome because I think most of those people are dead now. And our own presence of the Philadelphia Society, like Russell Kirk, M.E. Bradford, Henry Regnery, and men of the Pantheon, everybody, almost everybody we could mention in that generation is gone. There are a few left. But you know what? They have spawned a new generation that is more numerous, in some ways more sophisticated, in many ways more scholarly. And that generation is spawning another generation. And that generation so spawned is here today and gave us the presentations that we were entitled and privileged to hear over the past few hours. And this the group. This is why I am finally, after relatively pessimistic analysis, am hopeful of the future. Because not only of the numbers of these people, but of the quality. Let me just tell you quickly that when we were staffing the Reagan administration in the first term, and we were staffing something I know a good deal about, the Justice Department in the second term, we couldn't find older people enough to take those jobs. There weren't that many conservatives of those age. We went to young people, younger than myself. One thing we did, by the way, Gene Myers here, is we raided almost the entire membership of the Federalist Society and put them in the Justice Department. But that's actually a very hopeful sign, is it not? That our preference for gray hair availed us naught. And we found ourselves going to the younger age cohorts because that's where the conservatives were. And each age cohort you go down, there are more of those people, like the ones who talked to us this weekend. And I really commend Stan Evans and Bill Campbell for having the imagination and the self-discipline not to go to the usual standbys on a topic that we are fairly familiar with, but to go to the young scholars who have something to say that we don't know, that we will learn from. While we're lavishing our applause on the general meeting, let me ask all the Weaver Fellows and ISI Salvatore Fellows who are here present to please stand. Don't be shy. They constituted a majority of our presentations today, and I must say that four of the other speakers besides are very close to our work and cooperate with us on an ongoing basis. It is not inevitable, then, that our collective memory must be lost. With the human and institutional resources that we have been fettered with this weekend, we should all of us have reason to hope that what has been done to sever the historical connection between our founders and ourselves can be undone in Chodorowsky. And undone by the generation that, not the one that's speaking from the podium, but the one that that's addressed us earlier tonight, earlier this weekend. Burke, at the moment of his most bitter parliamentary defeat, remember, said, he gave up on his colleagues in the parliament, but he says, I attest the rising generation. Now, why should the rising generation listen to us? Put yourself in the place of an undergraduate of keen mind and superior preparation, a student who likes to read and dispute and flex the muscles of his mind. What does the left offer him? Turgid Marxist tracks, the straitjacket of the closed system, a politically correct jargon of a welter of bewildering interest groups, a false compassion that is but thinly disguised as a thinly disguised lust for power in the people's name, but notably without the people's participation. And what do the conservatives of the great tradition offer him? They offer a rich and various story that Russell Kirk once called a tale of four cities. Jerusalem of the one God and his incarnation. And Athens, the birthplace of democracy and of philosophical investigations so complete that all future ones served as footnotes. And Rome of the stern Republican fathers of the rule of law. And London, mother of parliaments and of the chartered rights of Englishmen. And then this weekend, the young scholars that spoke to us of a fifth city, Philadelphia, our own Philadelphia, where our fathers taught that self-government can be preserved from the corruption of power by dividing power against itself. So you have done that. You have added the fifth city. And you offer not just historical analysis. You offer allegiance born of a love of the truths that our founders' tradition embodies. That has which has made your lives rich, you wish to share freely with those students whose life of the mind is before them. You offer them your hands to boost them under the shoulders of the giants of the West, and from there they will see farther than any of us. So let us believe with that same faith that abided in Burke, that the best of the new generation will clasp your proffered hands and that they themselves, in good time, will offer theirs to those who follow. Thank you. Not only does our next speaker need no introduction, it is probably impossible to construct an introduction of our next speaker. So without further ado, let me introduce Mr. Jefferson.